In going over these chapters, they underline the principle that parenting is some serious stuff. In fact, one person said that a parent is a partner with God in discipling their children. Great way to look at it. A parent is a partner with God in discipling their children. But what happens when parents are passive and non-involved with their children? What happens when they don't really get into their world and understand their world and take the time to learn their children and their temperaments, their likes, their dislikes? As is the Lord's style, as I was preparing for this study this week, I had a couple of episodes with my own son where he, what we would call, interrupted me. And at times like that turn out to be appointments rather than interruptions. And wouldn't you know, just when I'm studying and thinking about parenting, on my office. And he just wanted a little companionship, a little bit of time. He just walked up to him and said, "Daddy, I have an owie." And then I kissed him and he said, "My owie goed away." He just wanted to talk, basically. And I thought as I looked at him, I never want to be guilty of giving him everything he needs except the one thing he needs the most, and that is my time. I never want to be guilty of being detached from him. So where he always thought, "Oh, Dad, yeah, Dad," he was busy. I know he loved me. He said that, but I never really saw it displayed. I don't want to be guilty of that. And what happens when parents are passive? Well, this chapter tells us. It shows the results of detached parents. Especially in this case of Jacob, a detached father. And by the way, this story that we read today, and some of the principles we cover, it's a story that is repeated thousands of times every single generation. There are two themes to the life of Joseph. The first theme, I know you've already been tracking with me since last week. It's the most obvious theme, and that is the life of Joseph himself. How he went from the pit to Egypt, the pinnacle, and how God sustained him. But there is another theme that runs throughout his life in his family, and that is the theme of results. And the focus is not so much on Joseph, because he turned out great. The focus is upon his dad, Jacob, and some of the mistakes he made in parenting. Yes, Joseph's 10 brothers were responsible to God for their own actions. You can't blame it all on mom and dad. However, there's some definite parental mistakes that were made on Jacob's part, and it bears that we slow down a little bit, backtrack even a little bit, and discover some of those mistakes. If you are young this morning and you don't have any children or you're not even married, don't turn off this kind of a study. Because your parents were in exactly the same place you are today at one time. If you are veteran parents, you've raised your children, bear with us this morning. In fact, you might have the tendency to look back and feel a little guilty as you discover some of the mistakes you've made yourself. Don't let that guilt settle in. Realize something. Let the life of Joseph reassure you that you can make a lot of mistakes and still have kids turn out great, as Joseph did. There is no one who has parenting down. You can read all of the books, and you can be determined that you're going to have it all down, but there is no such thing on this earth as a perfect parent. We are all learning. None of us has it down pat. We're learning, we're making mistakes, and we're getting tired along the way. It's like the kid who was talking to his other friend and said, "My dad's going to a PTA meeting. What is PTA? And he goes, "I don't know. I think it means poor, tired adults." Something like that. Not too far from the truth. Verse 12, we get some insight into Jacob's parenting on just these verses. "Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel," who is Jacob, "said to Joseph, Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them. So he said to them, Here I am. And he said to him, Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me. So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. And a certain man found him there. He was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, saying, What are you seeking? So he said, I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding the flocks. And the man said, They have departed from here, for I heard them say, Let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now, right off the bat, we can make a keen observation into the kind of a parent that Jacob was. Jacob, as a father, in some respects knew his children, but in many respects he did not even know them at all. He knew that outwardly they were corrupt, they were violent, because you'll read a few things this morning as we track this. He knew their outward activity, but he failed to be in touch with their inward feelings. He failed to know that the 10 sons feeding the flock had inwardly problems with Joseph. Jealousy, anxiety, and hatred. If Jacob knew that, he wouldn't dare send Joseph to go narc on his brothers again like he did last week. If he was in touch with the fact that his 10 brothers hated Joseph's guts and were jealous, he wouldn't have said, Hey, Joseph, put on that real nice robe and go tell me how your brothers are doing. Especially since Joseph was a favored son. So in many respects, this dad was out of touch with the inward feelings of his own children. And there's a couple reasons why. It seems to be a pattern, a habit all through his life. I want you to look at a couple scriptures with me that give us insight into his parenting. Look back at chapter 30 for just a moment. A couple of tragic events occur during the life of Jacob that we touched on last week. I want you to notice the reaction of this dad to these things. In chapter 30, just as an introduction to this, in verse 43, it tells us that Jacob was pretty well off. It says, Thus the man became exceedingly prosperous, had large flocks, female and male servants, camels and donkeys. God blessed his life, prospered him financially. And he had a rather large business of raising and breeding animals. Later on, as Jacob goes back into the land of Canaan after the whole Laban incident, as he's going back, he arrives at a place called Shechem, which we just read about in chapter 37. He sent Joseph to Shechem. He liked Shechem, and he bought a good chunk of land there to raise his flocks on. And in fact, they settled there temporarily. It seems that Jacob passed the business on to his 10 sons. It became a very profitable business. And his sons were kind of keeping the flocks and taking over the family business and expanding the business while they were at Shechem. However, an incident happened while the family lived at Shechem before they went back to Hebron. And that is, Jacob's only daughter, Dinah, was forcibly raped by a young man by the name of Shechem. However, this young lad who raped Dinah didn't want to dump her. It wasn't a love 'em, leave 'em relationship. He really wanted to establish a marriage relationship. And so the young man Shechem goes to his dad and he says, Dad, I want you to go to Jacob and tell him that I want his daughter's hand in marriage. I want to work out this deal. I know what I've done is wrong. I want to work this out and I want to marry her. We don't know exactly what Jacob's reaction was to this, but we do know what the 10 brothers' reaction was. Look over at chapter 34. Without going through the whole chapter, the brothers say, look, you did a bad thing and you are uncircumcised and we are circumcised, so we want everyone in your camp, everyone in your family who is a male to be circumcised. They said, fair enough. In verse 25 of chapter 34, it came to pass on the third day when they were in pain, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. Mass murder. And they killed Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, their donkeys, and what was in the city and what was in the field, and all of their wealth. All their little ones and their wives they took captive, and they plundered even all that was in the houses. Now, what was Dad's response to this whole thing? Verse 30. Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, now listen to the wording here, you have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me, and I shall be destroyed, and a little P.S., and my household, and I. He uses I and me through most of his sentence. And notice their response to his reaction, that they said, should he treat our sister like a harlot? The response of Jacob shows a selfish, preoccupied father who at most rebuked his sons. You know, you really shouldn't have killed them, sons. It made me look bad. And he was so concerned about his own status, he rebuked him a little bit, got hot under the collar, but he didn't do anything. There's no disciplinary action involved. He just rebukes him, says he shouldn't have done it. And he's concerned about his own status. Look at chapter 35. God said to Jacob, arise, go to Bethel and dwell there and make an altar to God, who appeared to you when you first fled from the face of Esau, your brother. And Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves and change your garments. And let us arise and go to Bethel. And I will make an altar there to God who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone. It is wonderful that God came to Jacob and commanded him to go build an altar. But now Jacob turns to his sons and in effect, if it was in modern vernacular, says, kids, we have to go to church. I'm bringing out this point because that is precisely the way many parents deal with wayward children. You kids are getting out of hand. You're going to church. I can't raise you. I don't know what's going on, but I'm going to take you and turn you over to the Sunday school department because that's their job. You see, there are a great many parents who think that the job of raising children belongs to the church, the Sunday school. Well, parents, we have your kids, if you come once a week, 52 hours a year. That leaves about 8,708 hours that you have them. Don't think that we are going to affect their lives any more than you are affecting your lives during those 8,700 hours. It won't work. There comes a point where if you have not begun discipline and loving attention at an early age, your kids grow up to a point, it's too late for church. It's too late to now impose the rules upon them. One author has an article called The Biggest Mistakes Parents Make in Affecting Teenagers, and he says, parents make a big mistake when they don't start affecting their children in a favorable manner from day one. But they make a bigger, perhaps the biggest mistake when they discover their dilemma late and become overly zealous to make up for lost time. A classic example is of two parents who attend a family life conference. On the way home, they write 25 rules to post on the refrigerator with the corresponding punishment for any infraction of the new regime. Upon arrival, they proudly announce, as of today, we're going to, on and on and on. It's no wonder that the 14 and 16-year-old teens raise an eyebrow, heave a sigh, and think, what have we gotten ourselves into? Suddenly plunging in with a lot of new rules can really upset the apple cart. While a zealous attitude for reform is commendable, how you deliver the new policies is directly related to how well they will be received by your teens. When teens aren't so keen on the new rule system, parents often get discouraged and give up altogether, not realizing it, that it was their manner that turned their kids off. There's another incident I want you to look at, also in chapter 35. It's after Rachel's death. Look up at verse 19. Chapter 35, verse 19. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. And Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. And it happened when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben, that's his oldest, went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel, or Jacob, heard about it. No evidence that he did anything about it. He heard about it. And that seems to be his mode of operation throughout his life. Even in the previous incident, if you were to read the whole chapter, when Dinah was raped, he heard about it. And he got mad at his sons because they made him look bad after they killed all the Shechemites. Laid with his wife, he heard about it. And now in chapter 37, he sends Joseph to his 10 sons in Shechem. Why? Well, now think about all we just read about. I mean, who knows what trouble they're getting into up there in Shechem? They killed a whole city before. I'm worried about my sons. It's not, I'm really worried about their health. I'm really worried about what they're doing. Not only what they're doing, but how their behavior will affect my investment. For look down at verse 14 of chapter 37. He tells Joseph, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks. And bring back word to me. And so he sent him off. A passive, preoccupied father was Jacob's mode of operation through his life. Refusal to discipline, refusal to be involved. Let's look at the son's response to Joseph, verse 18. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. They look off in the horizon. The sun is just right, and they see a figure coming toward them. Hey, who is that? I don't know, but the walk looks familiar. Oh, I know who that is. Look at that robe shining in the sun. That's Joseph. And all those memories came back. You remember when he narked on us before? Yeah, I hated him for that. I don't forgive him. I never have. Remember those stupid dreams he had too? How that we're going to bow down to him? And right then and there, when they see him walking, they start conspiring together. Verse 20, come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we shall say, some wild beast had devoured him. And we shall see what becomes of his dreams. But Reuben heard about it and delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness. Do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. They took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was coming a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. and his brothers listened. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, the price of a slave, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Now, at this point, we tend to look at Reuben's interruption of their brother's plot as heroic. Well, good old Reuben, the firstborn, stepping in. It would seem that he's really concerned for Joseph, but I'm not so sure. Because Reuben quickly agrees in the cover-up plot of telling his dad the lie that it was a wild beast who ate him. And there's no protest at all by Reuben when the Ishmaelites come. He doesn't say, no, don't do this. I want to bring him back home. You got to remember something about Reuben. Reuben was the firstborn, which means the right of inheritance was ripped off by Joseph. That's how Reuben would see it. Jacob gave Reuben's right to Joseph. So Reuben hated him for that. Also, Reuben committed incest with one of his father's wives. Nothing is said about him doing anything about it, but he never forgot it either. And I'm sure at this point he's thinking, I've got to figure out a way to recover myself and my position so that perhaps my position won't be permanently passed on to Joseph and I'm off the hook for the sin of incest with my father's wives. Because I want you to notice something in verse 29. Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit. And he tore his clothes, and he returned to his brothers, and he said, the lad is no more, and where shall I go? All of a sudden, he's real concerned about himself. Where shall I go? Perhaps he escaped. Maybe he's going to go back and tell Dad. I mean, it was my idea to throw him in the pit. I'm the firstborn. I could be hung on this one. I'm already in trouble. Where am I going to go? He's very concerned about number one, himself, like father, like son, concerned about himself. Then we get the plot of Judah up in verse 26, who said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill him? Hey, this doesn't make sense. Why kill him when we can make money off the deal? Again, like father, like son. That's the story of Jacob. He was a deceiver. He was a conniver. He did things for only financial gain most of his life. If you look at the life of Jacob, a man who lacked the intuition to know his children enough and be sensitive to his children, you see the same thing patterned out in his own children. They have become just like Dad, insensitive, not caring about feeling, not caring about relationship. And because of that, there are some principles that emerge out of what we have just read concerning parenting, things to avoid. Now, I have three little blanks on your worksheet that I want you to fill in. This is not complete. It is only what is implied in this text. What we learn from Jacob as a parent is what not to do. You see, the kids that you and I have been given to us by the Lord, period. You don't test drive them first. You don't get a chance to take it home for a couple weeks, try it out, see if you like it, and go, no, I don't really like this model. Hair isn't quite right, whines a little too much, doesn't sleep all night long. I'm going to trade it in. They're yours. Because of that, there are pitfalls that all of us are faced with. We need to avoid. The first thing we need to do that is implied from this text is we need to study our children. Study your kids. Your kids study you, Mom and Dad. That's why they're so good at manipulation. They know exactly what you do. They know that if you say, Johnny, stop that, if you really mean that, if you're really going to follow through with action, because they've watched you make idle threats and nothing's worked, so they know you, they've studied you. Study your children. It is so easy to get out of touch with our children. It's so easy to not understand what's going on in their world, especially in our culture. Now, if that was a problem for Jacob, in ancient times, in an agrarian society where he was supposedly home most of the time, don't you think it is a real threat to us in our modern society? Where it is expected that dad be gone all day, if not all week, and be married to his job, and the job sucks all of the energy out of dad and all of the creativity, so that by the time he comes home, dad is so worn out, he doesn't want to give time to anybody. And it's very easy to get out of touch. Very dangerous position. To lose touch with them spiritually and emotionally. The Bible says that we are to train up a child in the way he should go. We're to train children. And that's different than teaching kids. You just don't sit a kid down and instruct him. To train is to mold a character. And to be able to mold a character, it takes studying that character. Because every child is different, has a different temperament, a different pain threshold, has different needs that present themselves at different times and in different ways. No two kids are alike. And so the application must be tailored to the child. There are certain things that never change, but there are certain methods of application that should change. We need to study our children so that we might train them. Don't compare your children with other children. The old, well, Johnny, why can't you be like Frankie? Ruins a child. Of course, the most intelligent answer usually comes from the kid himself. Because I'm not Frankie, that's why. I'm me. Avoid the comparison. Study your child. Let it be individual. Number two, fight passivity. Fight being a passive parent. Be active and be involved and fight with everything you have passivity. Passivity is one of the greatest enemies of parenting. If you are a passive parent, you are almost ensuring that your child will be insecure and angry. There are people who become parents and just sort of have a spiritual cloud around them. They plod through life and just hope that everything's going to turn out all right. Well, we'll just trust the Lord. And that's a cop-out many times, because in the New Testament, trust, faith, are active, never passive. They demand action. Faith without works is dead. And parenting without involvement is dead. Fight passivity. And Jacob knew nothing at all about what his kids had planned concerning the killing of the Shechemites until it was all over, and all he did is get mad a little bit. He was not involved. I have a Gallup poll called the National Gallup Youth Survey that says of 1,000 teenagers, 25% do not discuss their day's activities with their parents. 42% had not received parental words of praise during a 24-hour period that was tested. Half had not gotten a hug or a kiss. And 54% had not heard the words, I love you. 79% said they had not been helped with homework by a parent. I love the story that is true of a man told when he was a kid. He said, when I was about 13 years old, my little brother was about 10. It was a Saturday and we were all around the table and dad says, I'm taking him to the circus today. We were all excited. As the day went on, it was about 12 o'clock noon. We were going to go to the circus in the afternoon. At about 12 o'clock, when we sat down for lunch, the phone rang and my dad picked it up and I knew trouble was brewing. There was something that came up at the office downtown that demanded his attention right there. And we were sure that our father was going to have to go down and we were bracing ourselves for the disappointment until we heard our dad say, I know it's important, but it's going to have to wait. And he hung up the phone. And he went back to the lunch table. And he said, my mom turned over to my dad, put her arm lovingly upon, or her hand on his arm, and said, honey, it's all right. The circus keeps coming back to town. The circus keeps coming back. He said, I know it does, but childhood doesn't. And my father made that decision to cancel something that was very important for us. You know, you imagine how that makes a child feel. that I am the most important thing to my Father. Be active, be involved. And finally, discipline. Avoid lack of discipline. Be a disciplined parent and discipline your children. And I want to explain that. Remember that little quote at the very beginning of this message that that man said? That a parent is a partner with God in discipling his children? Do you know that discipline and disciple have the same root word? A disciple is well-disciplined, and it starts young. And that means we have to take in a little spankaroo every now and then. Kids are different, we said. They have different temperaments. They have different personalities. But they have one thing in common, all of them. A self-assertive nature that must be broken. That's the one thing every child has in common. And if you are a parent that refuses to discipline, you will ruin your child. You will absolutely ruin your child. Our society has taught us to be scared of spanking your kids. It's a hands-off. Don't spank them. You might damage their psyche. And so little Junior throws a rock through a plate glass window. Dare not touch him, or you might hinder his genius of throwing rocks. Don't spank him. And there are parents that are petrified that if they spank their child, the child will not love them. And that if you love your child, you never have to spank them. There's nothing that could be farther from the truth. Listen to the word of God on this matter. He who spares his rod hates his son. Proverbs 13:24. But he who loves him disciplines him promptly. Which means early, at the onset of the crime that is committed. Listen to Proverbs 19. Chasten your son while there's hope. And do not set your heart on his destruction. What that means is, in the Old Testament, if there was a wayward youth that refused reform as he was getting older and he was totally out of hand, he was publicly stoned. So he's saying, Dad, discipline your kid early so that that won't happen. Chasten your son while there's hope and don't set your heart on his destruction. They would actually publicly stone them. Don't get any ideas, parents, by the way, on that one. Doesn't work today. Proverbs 22. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. You have here the problem and the solution. Foolishness, that's the problem. It's bound up in the heart of every child, every human being. But the rod of correction will drive it far from him. Now, most of us agree with the first part of that. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. Not a lot of us are willing to consistently carry out number two, using the rod to drive it far from him. By the way, now hang with me on this one. The word rod literally means club. Hang with me. I am so glad my dad never knew this passage of scripture, folks. In the Hebrew, the obvious meaning is using something other than a part of your body, like a hand. It never says spank with a hand, although as when they're young children, I can see the validity of that. But if God meant that we ought to use our hands or our fists, He would have written that. He said a rod. It also means a stick. Something that is not associated with your body. Let your hands be for loving and affirmation and correction. But the rod, or the stick, or the paddle, or whatever you want to use, that won't permanently damage the child, but that will get his attention. Use that as a method of discipline. I want to note something here, by the way. We're not talking about crushing a child's spirit. We're talking about breaking self-will. There is some form of discipline that parents use that is horrible, and it's not discipline at all, it's brutality. They take their hand and they slap a child across the face. That's not discipline, and it's certainly not biblical. That's brutality, and it's wrong. In fact, you should never, ever strike anyone on the face. But using the rod is helpful. A paddle, a stick, or whatever. I also got to mention this before we come to a close with this, and that is there's two kinds of discipline, moms and dads. There's corrective discipline and preventative discipline. Just like a doctor who is a good doctor practices both corrective medicine and preventative medicine. Unfortunately, most of us are only familiar with corrective discipline. It's like the kid who was asked, "Does your mom ever spank you?" or "Did your mom ever spank you?" "Did my mom ever spank me?" She had a paddle that hung up in the kitchen underneath a motto that read, "I need thee every hour." Boy, was I spanked. Now that's corrective. But if you want corrective discipline in your home to work well, it must be meshed and reinforce preventative discipline. Example, do you spend time with your kids? Do you read to them? Do you love them? Do you sing with them? Do you play with them? If you don't, perhaps you have no right to spank them. "I'm their parent. I have any right to do whatever I want to." Yep, you do. But you don't guarantee the results that way. You prevent it by spending time with them, loving them, giving them attention. Then you have the right to reinforce that with corrective discipline. Now, a few tips on discipline, and I'm learning them all myself. Don't use idle threats or bribes. "Now, Johnny, eat your broccoli." Time passes. Johnny doesn't eat his broccoli. "Johnny, would you please eat your broccoli for Mommy?" Johnny doesn't pay any attention to it. "Johnny, eat your broccoli!" Johnny doesn't pay any attention to it. "Johnny, if you don't eat your broccoli, you're not going to get any cake." Johnny doesn't eat his broccoli. Sure enough, 20 minutes later, the unused broccoli is taken away and the brand new piece of cake is on his plate. Johnny learns quick. Mommy makes idle threats, doesn't follow through. Never bribe your child. Never threaten your child. Promise him. And then follow through. "Johnny, if you do that, and I told you not to, I'm going to spank you. Don't do that." "Johnny, I told you not to do that." You don't need to do that. Say it once. If they don't do it, follow through. Don't threaten them. Promise them. So they know when Mom says it, it will happen. Number two, admit when you're wrong. Admit when you're wrong to your kids. Say, "I'm sorry" a lot to them when you are wrong. They don't expect perfection, but they do expect honesty. And finally, think of the long-range effect of discipline, not the short-range. You cannot evaluate, parents, your discipline to your children by the immature way they are thinking about you now. It's no concern what they think about you now, but what they think about you 20 years from now. When they can turn back and say, "Thank you, I love you, it worked." So don't gauge your effectiveness by their evaluation of you now. "Well, my child said he doesn't like me when I spank him." Well, figure it out. No one would. But they will one day. The story ends by saying they took Joseph's tunic, verse 31, killed a kid of the goats, dipped the tunic in blood. They sent the tunic of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" He recognized it and he said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." And Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, mourned for his son many days, and all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Sad. Sad day for Jacob. And yet, his own 10 sons turned out just like he did. Very, very much like he did. And all he has now is mourning the memory of his son. And if Jacob were to write a song, and he were around in the 1960s, it would have been this song. "My child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way. But there were planes to catch. There were bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away. And he's talking before I knew it. And as he grew, he'd say, 'I'm going to be like you, Dad. You know, I'm going to be like you.' And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. 'When are you coming home, Dad? Well, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, son. You know, we'll have a good time then. My son turned 10 just the other day. He said, "Thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play." "Can you teach me how to throw?" I said, "Not today. I've got a lot to do." He said, "That's okay." And he walked away, but his smile never dimmed and said, "I'm going to be like him. Yeah. You know, I'm going to be like him." And the Cat's in the Cradle and the Silver Spoon, Little Boy Blue and the Man in the Moon. "When you coming home, Dad?" "I don't know when, but we'll get together then, son. You know, we'll have a good time then." Well, he came from college just the other day. So much like a man, I just had to say, "Son, I'm proud of you. Can you sit for a while?" He shook his head and said with a smile, "What I'd really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys. See you later. Can I have them, please?" "When you coming home, son?" "I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. You know, we'll have a good time then." I've long since retired, and my son moved away. I called him up just the other day. I said, "I'd like to see you, if you don't mind." He said, "I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time." You see, my new job's a hassle. The kids have the flu. But it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. Sure nice talking to you. And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me, he'd grown up just like me. My son was just like me. That's Jacob's song. Doesn't have to be ours. Let's pray that God would make these principles real throughout our lives. Father, take home these things that we have heard today, these things that we have seen in Jacob's life. Help us, Lord, to study our children, to be involved with them, and to discipline them early as a gesture of our love, lest we have to sing a song such as this. I pray, Lord, that we would treasure those precious lives that are in our hands to be molded and unfolded. Do that by your grace. In Jesus' name, amen.